This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Getting COVID-19 vaccines to the public is a hot topic, and many of us may not be aware of the role supply chain management plays in the background of all of this. Today, we have three experts in the field of supply chain management to offer us some insight. Amru Awashi is an assistant professor of operations management at Kelly School of Business at IUPUI. Mohan Tadikanda is a professor of operations management at Kelly School of Business at IUPUI. And Kyle Katani is a professor of operations management at IU Bloomington. We definitely want to get to the bottom of the great toilet paper and paper towel debacle of 2020, but first, let's get some insight into what supply management is and why it's important. So I'll start off with you, Amru. Can you tell us what exactly is a supply chain and why is it important?
Sure. Good afternoon, Miriam and everybody. So a supply chain is the network between a company, its suppliers, and customers. It's what a company needs to deliver on its mission, on its goals. It's how you source your raw materials that come into your operations and how you deliver that to the customers. Like you mentioned, about a year ago, everybody thought supply chain was a black box. We didn't think about it or worry about it. But, you know, retailers need supply chains to get the raw materials that they're going to, or the products that they're going to have to stock the shelves to sell. Hospitals need supply chains as they worry about getting PPE in from the door, you know, into the loading docks, getting shots in patients' arms. It's all these linkages that companies have between each other that they need to deliver on the finished good.
Could you elaborate a little bit, Amru, on maybe an example of something from start to finish, you know, what that kind of looks like?
Sure. So if you can think of PPE, let's think of a mask, right? Everybody's thinking of a mask. You'd need that cotton from somewhere. It needs to go into a cotton mill after it's picked. There's some kind of processing that happens. Then it goes probably to a facility. It's made into a cloth or some larger fabric rolls. Then it's sent to a supplier, probably a manufacturer that would cut it into sizes. And in addition to that, they'd probably need the elastic bands, the little plastic pieces that you're finding, the metal piece that you find on top of the mask. All those need to come together at the facility that's assembling those masks. And then they go on to the retailer and eventually get shipped out to the customer.
Okay. Now, Mohan, can you tell us a little bit about what the role someone who is a supply chain manager, I'm assuming that's a role that someone plays to ensure that all of these moving parts come together?
So, Miriam, it is a role, but it is not always called that. There are people who are involved in the planning and the execution of how we get our work done in our restaurant, in our hospital, wherever it may be, and in working with the people who provide us services and parts and materials and ingredients, and then, of course, our customers and their customers. So supply chain is a very, very broad area with many, many different terms that are used for people who work in different parts of it. A lot of people do supply chain work without a supply chain title or necessarily even recognizing that they are supply chain people specifically. Some common terms are operations manager, procurement, distribution, customer service, and things like that.
All right. Well, we've gotten just a little bit of this background now on this supply chain. Kyle, could you give us a little bit of insight into why we haven't heard so much about it until now? And if there's any particular areas you feel the news industry has not really covered?
Thank you, Miriam. It is interesting to me that supply chain management has been around a long, long time. The Romans were very good at supply chain management. The Mongolian Empire was good at supply chain management. The Ottoman Empire and many other of these empires were good at supply chain management. But in the last few decades, supply chain management capabilities have exploded with the availability of information flows that can travel around the globe instantaneously and with the concurrent data processing and analysis capabilities that were not possible prior to the advent of the computer and the internet. So material flows have also become dramatically more efficient with cargo ships and multiple modes of transport, such as planes, trains, and trucks. And money is traveling around the globe very quickly. So while the world has become much more connected and interdependent in ways that have dramatically improved our standard of living, at the same time, these advances have made us more vulnerable, not only to the transmission of viruses and things like that, other diseases, but also to these disruptions of the goods and foods and lifestyles that our ancestors never had the opportunity to experience. But ultimately, there are trade-offs in everything. And I think that the press has noted in this past year the vulnerability of supply chains, but I think that the press underappreciates, perhaps, or understates the advancements in supply chain management that have made our lives so much better.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely do want to touch upon this later in the program about sort of security issues with supply chain management and the advent of technology. Would it be fair, Amru, to say that technology has kind of made this a little bit trickier or more difficult to navigate? We often think of technology as this easy answer to everything.
I think technology has made it easier. Unfortunately, what happens is we think that technology will solve all the problems. So technology is enabling us to have more flexible supply chains, have more data and more information, and thus building on what Kyle's talking, we're responding faster. But it's not an easy button that we press that'll fix all our problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of getting things to run efficiently and using technology, Mohan, How does one actually get a supply chain to run efficiently? What is sort of the best practice?
It's amazing to think about and to see. So the key to supply chains running and running efficiently is coordination. It's purposeful coordination. It's the planned interactions of your organization with your suppliers and your customers. So the restaurant's interactions with the folks that provide the ingredients, and the restaurant's interactions with people that purchase from them. And then those who provide the ingredients may have had their own suppliers who help them with the cans for the ingredients. And then the customers of the restaurant may have their own customers, and when they break down a bigger batch of food into a smaller batch. So we have all these moving parts, and the key to successful supply chains is recognizing the different parts and planning ahead of time how they will interact with each other. So this requires a bit of a supply chain mindset instead of a go-it-alone mindset. We're just one organization, we'll do our own thing. But we have to think about working with other organizations. And it is often said that it's not necessarily an individual organization that competes or serves. It's actually an entire supply chain that competes or serves. So we might think about the hospital, but we're really thinking about the entire hospital supply chain when we think about the hospital that's providing services.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with three experts in the field of supply chain management. Amru Awaishe is an assistant professor of operations management at Kelly School of Business at IUPUI. Mohan Tatikanda is a professor of operations management at Kelly School of Business at IUPUI as well. And Kyle Katani is a professor of operations management at IU Bloomington. So let's talk about the vaccine. I think that is something that is on everyone's mind right now. Like, why can't anyone seem to get it together with distributing this vaccine, and how does supply management factor into all of this? Are they just, are we shooting the messenger with supply management folks, or do they have a huge role to play? Amru, what do you think?
Sure. I mean, the first thing we need to keep in mind is these vaccines are entirely new, right? This is simply a product that we did not have 12 months ago. We didn't need to worry about it. And a lot of us have been following the clinical trials and development of the vaccines from that end, but we haven't been thinking about, okay, after they are approved, how are we going to get these shots in arms? And really, these are entire supply chains that had to be built out from scratch. And so we can think of the first mile. How are these companies getting the vaccines from their manufacturing facilities into these central distribution areas, and what we see the federal government kind of shipping them out to the various states and the allotment they're getting on a weekly basis, the middle mile, which is where they're sending it from the state, is sending out to these various places, and finally the final mile. And I think what a lot of people are worried about is this last mile delivery, and we started to hear that Amazon is very good at this last mile delivery. How can we incorporate some more of these e-commerce players? And really, we've come together quite well. Just today, we're hearing news and remote areas of the Appalachian Mountains, remote areas in Arizona. There's all these people are getting now shots in arms. So we figured out these various elements. I think the key to understand is, again, this is simply a thing that did not exist before that we have to worry about. But we are now, as part of the planning, I mean, there was some planning that went ahead that enabled us to get ready. If you think about these vaccines, some of them are needed to be stored in ultra cold storage. And I'll give you an example of things that people didn't need to worry about. So when that package arrives, a person can't just put their hands in there and take the vial out. It's extremely cold. So you have to ship these vaccines with special gloves that somebody can wear that would enable them to put their hand in and take the vaccines out of ultra cold storage. I mean, it's this kind of detail that you think about. There was a lot of discussion around the sixth dose that was present in some of the Pfizer vials. Well, you needed special kinds of needles, very precise needles to extract that sixth dose. And there are many instances in places where they ran out of those needles and they didn't have the necessary supply. So they were wasting that sixth dose. They simply could not extract that sixth dose from the vial. So it's getting all these elements that you need to come together at the right time to be able to deliver the shot in the arm. The best way to think about it is if they run out of the rubbing alcohol that they need to put on before they inject the needle in there, they simply can't administer the vaccine.
That's really fascinating. I'd never heard about all these sort of little details that go with the vaccine. You just imagine it's a bunch of vials being sent and then somebody opens them up and gives them to people. So, I mean, how does supply chain management factor into that? Are they making sure all of these pieces are together, let's say, in the shipment before it goes out?
Yes, I mean, so some components they try and include in the shipment as it's going out, but it's also coordinating with the suppliers, with the needle suppliers, with the alcohol swab suppliers, with the Band-Aid suppliers that need to be put on after to make sure that, because they're not all coming from the same location. So how do we make sure they all arrive at the same time when you need to deliver that vaccine? And it's a complicated process, and that's how you compete with the entire supply chain working hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely something to think about, and I think you've really brought to light an aspect that many of us have overlooked and underappreciated, which is there are so many different pieces to this puzzle. We'll be right back in a bit. We are speaking with our guests about how the pandemic pushed the field of global supply chain management to the forefront. You can get in on the conversation with your questions and comments by tweeting us at All in Indiana or leave us a note on our Facebook page. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We also have a special app called All in Vox Pop. You can find it in the App Store on your phone where you can leave us an audio message, and we'd love to include it on the show. So if you have a moment, let us know how you think about how things have been handled right now with supply chain management. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back shortly. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. With us is Ashley C. Ford, the Indianapolis author whose new memoir, Somebody's Daughter, is a New York Times bestseller. Ashley, I want to get back to your book and putting it together and all of those elements. What was it like when you finally finished the book and it got released?
After 10 years of working on something, to have it finally be done, finally be released, finally be out in the world. You know, I think I was prepared to feel a little bit more sad about that than I actually did. Like, I thought part of me would feel like, oh, I miss it. I miss when it was just mine. And I get why some people feel that way. But no, I felt like, yes, it is out in the world. It is a thing that exists. It's a thing that I can hold in my hands. I'm so proud of myself. And that's how I feel. I feel very, very proud of myself.
And when did you find out it was on the bestseller list for the New York Times? What was that like?
Okay, so I found out that it was on the New York Times bestseller list about an hour before I had a book event with Oprah Winfrey. And I found out I was on the New York Times bestseller list. And then I found out that my friend Clint was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And then Clint FaceTimed me and we freaked out in the car together about this happening and told each other congratulations. I had to go get ready for my event. He had to go give his kids a bath. And then we had the event. And afterwards, my neighbor showed up on the doorstep with two bottles of champagne. And that's how the rest of the night went.
Wow, that's cool. And so it's just also funny because it's like you're just doing average everyday things, meeting Oprah, you know, that's just an everyday thing. And you find out about this. So how was that event with Oprah? Like, how did she come about learning about your book? Or was she involved in the publishing of it?
She was, actually. My book is published as an Oprah book, which is her imprint through Flatiron Publishing. I initially met with the Flatiron Group about publishing my book, along with a few other publishing houses. And my book went to auction. And when the final offers at the auction came in, Flatiron's offer was paired with the offer from an Oprah book. So from that moment, you know, I guess I was under that umbrella, which has been really lovely, really, really great. And doing the event with Oprah was, I mean, it was amazing. There's nothing I could have ever done, ever done to impress my mother-in-law more.
Yeah, it's good to get in with the mother-in-law on her good side. And so when it comes to sort of Oprah's impact on this book, do you feel like it had an impact to have her endorsement, to have some of these other folks in your circle?
I mean, absolutely. It helps, obviously, and I would never, you know, pretend that that isn't the case, you know, but there's the flip side of that, which is that things can be overhyped. And you might find something out in a million different directions, but if when it finally lands, it's not worth anything, or it definitely isn't, by your estimation, worth the hype it received, it's like that can also be devastating for an artist and for a career, you know? And I didn't want that. So I knew that I wanted this to be something that I could be proud of, no matter who was behind it, no matter who supported it. And even though it did receive a lot of support from people who are amazing, people who are good friends, people who are also widely influential, I feel good about the fact that when the work shows up, I think it holds up to the praise.
Right, absolutely. And you've been doing a lot of media, obviously, for this. Everyone is trying to interview you, including me. And what has that been like? Is it difficult to try to, for example, revisit stories in your book and have to, like, talk about them over and over?
I thought it would be harder than it is. I was prepared, I think, for a much more visceral reaction to having to talk about these things so often. But the truth is, I think I did a pretty good job working with my mental health team to make sure that I was in a good enough place to regulate and take good care of myself while I'm having these conversations. So because I've been so well supported and I have such an awesome support system, I think that what has been at times slightly frustrating could have been a lot worse. And I'm glad that it hasn't gotten to a point where I'm breaking down or freaking out. I just have my moments and I take my moments and know that I'm going to be loved on the other side of them.
And what has the reception to the book been like so far? What have you heard from readers?
So far, it's been really good. The biggest or most common criticism I've gotten so far is just that they feel like it's too short. Mm-hmm. Like they would have wanted more, which is of all the criticism that could be offered in the world, I'll take it. I will absolutely take that in and bear that in mind. Otherwise, the reception has been largely positive. And I mean positive in a way that feels really affirming for me. I think at times I absolutely worried that the story I was telling, even though it was a memoir, was just so specific that it might be hard to relate to for people who didn't have experiences that were incredibly similar to mine. And that has just not been the case so far. So far, people who have lived lives that are very different from mine have connected to the book in unexpected ways. And that makes me really very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking even for myself reading, you know, just the childhood and some of the stuff, it's like I could feel myself as you in a way. I don't know how to explain it, but it's just like it really took me there. And just the
prose was amazing. No, I hear that a lot.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's not just me. But yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's. I don't even know how to explain it, but everybody should go and read it. If you're listening and have any questions or comments for Ashley, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Now, I know as artists, authors, it's also kind of scary to put yourself out there because of the critical reception that you might get. Have you heard anything that was just like, I don't even want to read this review?
Not really, but I am not the kind of person who would seek that out. You know, I don't think of myself, I don't think of myself as a person who exhibits an abundance of self-control, but when it comes to the internet and comments and reviews and things like that, like things that people do or say that seem out of turn, like not a critical review that has merit, but something that is cruel or unkind in a way that is unnecessary. Yeah, I would never go looking for that. I wouldn't read it if it showed up in my inbox. I would let that exist with and for the person who wrote it, because that's who they wrote it for. They didn't write it for me, you know? So that's okay. It can exist out there. I'll be cool over here.
Right. Well, what was the most difficult thing you ran into during the process of writing this book, or was it smooth sailing the whole way?
It was not smooth sailing. I don't think it would have took 10 years if it was smooth sailing. It was rough. I mean, first, you have to get to a place where you even think you're good enough to start writing it. Then once you think you're good enough to start writing it, you have to convince yourself you even have the right to write it. Then once you convince yourself you have the right to write it, you have to convince yourself that if you write it, you will not be betraying anyone, nor will you be hurting anyone. There's just all of these layers I had to get through in myself in order to be able to write the first sentence, the first word, the first essay, to be able to call it a book. There are all these milestones I had to hit along the way that I see a way where they could be compressed. I see a book that could be written that way. But this was not that book. This book and I had to fight. We had to wrestle for a while. So, I mean, I went to writing residencies. I was at Hedgebrook on Whidbey Island in Washington in 2014. I worked with writing coaches. I transcribed and interviewed people, friends and members of my family. I tried to stay involved, you know, with the story, but it wasn't really until I was getting ready to finish my proposal that I had anything that made sense as a book. And that was in 2017. So that took 7 years of the 10. So yeah, it's, no, it has not been easy. It has been a process. It has been a lot of confronting myself in order to tell the truth.
Right. And I mean, so 10 years for you to get to this point, was there a way to hold yourself accountable? I'm just curious because I think of, like, you know, when you have to do writing exercises or things, it's like you're like, get up every day and write for an hour at 5 a.m. How are you able to stay accountable and just get through it all?
Yeah, I'm not that kind of writer. I don't write every day. I never have. I can't, that's just not the way my brain works. I have ADHD, and I have learned that in order to complete projects or in order to do things that mean something to me, I have to be able to attack them from multiple angles. And my book was the same way. So I had to be reading memoirs. I had to be reading my old journals. I had to be interviewing people in my life while I was taking notes and while I was finding photos that reminded me of things and while I was listening to music from when I was 13 years old. It's like I had to create a multifaceted approach to writing the book just to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very immersive. I guess, you know, the way I've just assumed a memoir gets written is like somebody has some memories and they write them down. But I mean, it's a lot more complex than that.
I mean, I think it could be that way for some people. You know, Jeanette Walls, who wrote The Glass Castle, which is one of the books that I was reading a lot when I was working on my book. She came to Ball State when I was a student there. And I remember her telling us that she was telling her husband some stories about her childhood. And he essentially was like, you're going to sit here for 6 weeks and you're just going to write as much as you can. And she did. And it was the first draft of her book, like when she was done in 6 weeks, she just sat down and wrote it, you know, and it was a messy first draft, you know, she said, but it was like a first draft. That is so far away from anything that happened to me. It's not even close. It's just opposite ends of the spectrum. And I think that every writer or person who seeks to write or make art of any kind, be creative, should know that you figure out your process. You're not like, you might start off being able to copy somebody else's process and like getting a start that way, but your process isn't always something that you sit down and make. Sometimes it's something that's revealed to you over time. Like now I know how I work, but that took time.
That's a good point, because I think for a lot of folks that are aspiring to write or create, they think they have to follow this perfect molded path, and it's like everybody is different.
Everybody, you know, and you really mess yourself up when you get to a place where you start shaming yourself for not being able to do it the way somebody else would do it, because all that shame is going to do is get in the way of getting it done. It's not going to help you. And it's not going to help you to be ashamed of the shame. Like, you just have to start noticing it and not judging it and moving forward so that you can make something you're proud of.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's a really good way to think about it, because I think you get into a vicious spiral of like, well, I didn't complete this and I'm no good. And then I'm not going to do it. And then it's like, you could have done it.
Yep. It's just in the end, not worth it. It's not even that it makes you bad. It's not even a bad thing to do. Like, let go of like the bad or good thing. Don't judge it. It just is. And you can move through it just like you can move through anything else.
Mm-hmm. And what's your advice for folks who are listening right now that are like, maybe I have a memoir in me? What is the steps that they should take?
You know, one of the things that I tell people a lot is that writing a memoir and publishing a memoir are not the same thing. You don't have to write something and then put it out into the world if that's not what you want to do or if you think you're not ready for that putting it out into the world part. You could write it just because you want to write it. You could keep it for yourself. You could put it in a drawer or leave it as a file on your computer until you put it in the trash and bury it forever, you know, whenever you want. You own your art. Nobody can take it from you. Nobody can do anything with it without your permission. So you might as well give yourself a shot and do what feels good to do. Make what it feels good to make and see what shows up.
Thank you for joining us. Ashley C. Ford is an Indianapolis author. Her new memoir, Somebody's Daughter, is now a New York Times bestseller. Up next, we look into the 1918 flu pandemic and see what lessons were learned and how it compares to the present pandemic, especially when it comes to health inequities. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. With us now to talk about the 1918 flu pandemic and to find out how health disparities looked back then is Elizabeth Wrigley Field, a sociologist at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, nice to be here.
So let's talk about a little bit about the stuff that you study around pandemics and life expectancy and inequity. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your research is and what you look into?
Sure. So I'm a mortality demographer. I study population patterns in death, and I've particularly focused on the 1900 to 1950 period and on infectious disease. So the 1918 flu is one of my big topics. And more recently, I've also focused on COVID mortality. Like a lot of other researchers, I made a kind of a major swerve in the last year to study the pandemic as it's been unfolding.
Well, earlier in the pandemic, we've heard that there have been a lot of comparisons with this 1918 flu pandemic. We're about a year into our own pandemic right now. How useful are these kinds of comparisons?
Well, it's a mixed bag. So there's a lot of things about 1918 that would be very familiar to us today. One is just the scale of the crisis and the way that it upended daily life. And also some of the ways that that was really controversial, I think, would be very familiar to us. So there were huge debates about whether to close schools, theaters, church services. Those things were often enacted by city governments, but were incredibly contentious. There was a lot of pushback against them. And because of that, those restrictions would often be eased up sooner than health experts would say was advisable. So a lot of this kind of thing, you would feel like, yeah, I can recognize those kinds of debates. There's a quote that I love from a Topeka, Kansas newspaper about this that says, you know, both the health commissioner and the health officer have been the target for gobs of criticism and insubordination against the autocracy they were establishing and depriving the citizens of the right to mingle with flu germs. Right. And, you know, it's sort of dripping with sarcasm, but it is reflecting this intense debate about what is legitimate to do to try to stop a respiratory pandemic from spreading throughout your population. And so in that sense, this is really the historical analog that I think is the closest fit for us to learn from. There's some other things that are very different. And the story about racial disparities is a kind of obvious one that comes to mind. But so is the story about age. Right. So there's some real senses in which who was affected by this pandemic are very different from COVID.
I'm curious to know then, now that you brought that up. So what were these differences in 1918 in terms of, you said, age? Who were the people that were most affected?
So 1918 is really different from almost every other flu virus, which is the flu always really affects very young people, infants and young children, and also very old people. And that was true in 1918. But in addition to that, the people who were really affected were people in their 20s and 30s. And that's pretty unprecedented. It is very different from COVID, which is incredibly sensitive to age. So you can predict very well someone's COVID risk by how old they are in this way that it's just sort of increasing the older someone gets. That's really, in 1918, it was very distinctive. We often describe the typical pattern of mortality risk as a J curve. So you can think about a kind of J that's tilted a little bit, where you've got this big risk at young ages, and then it declines, and then there's this kind of shooting up at the high end. And if that's a J, 1918 is more like a W, where you've got high, young, and old ages, but then this big spike in the middle. And there's really nothing else that looks like that.
And you also mentioned about, you know, this, it seems like there's a history of people not trusting health officials. I think earlier when I was hearing things about the 1918 flu pandemic, nobody really talked about there was controversy too then. And so I'm wondering, were there any lessons learned in that pandemic? For example, lifting of things earlier than health officials, you know, said was necessary. Did they learn lessons from that? Is that something we should be looking at?
I think so. I mean, I think the lessons are pretty clear. There's a few different attempts to look systematically at comparing across cities based on what kinds of measures they took to prevent the 1918 flu virus from spreading. And cities that took more aggressive measures had fewer deaths than you would predict for those cities. And that pattern is pretty clear. But it's also not as big a difference as you might think it would be. And the experts who've studied this think that that's because there was no city that really maintained the shutdowns for as long as they should have. So the mayors and governors who agreed to do things like school closures, theater closures, limiting church services, they came in for just a relentless attack from business communities in particular, also in some case from churches who wanted to be able to hold in-person services. And they were, in general, only willing to resist that pressure for relatively short periods of time. And that really did have an impact.
Would you be able to, through the data, be able to say that, you know, this many deaths would have been avoided if in 1918 they had been stricter for a longer period of time?
You know, you might be able to model that. It's a little bit challenging because part of the thing about infectious diseases is that their spread it has a multiplying effect, right? And so as you allow more unchecked spread, then you have more people in the population who are infecting other people. So the studies about this, which are by people like a wonderful infectious disease researcher like Mark Lipsitch, I think they have attempted to estimate how many more lives could have been saved with more aggressive measures. But all of those kinds of numbers are always sort of, you want to take with a grain of salt, I think.
When it comes to life expectancy as a tool to measure things, how useful is it? And what does it reveal when we're talking about, I guess, you know, changing things in communities to ensure that everybody has equity and access?
My internet went out, so I missed the first part of the question. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. That's the way the world works these days. You could just fill in the blank with whatever you think I said. but actually, yeah. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how useful is using life expectancy as this tool or metric, and how does it, I guess, in the long term, help with navigating situations of inequity and access?
Got it. Well, life expectancy is sort of a double-edged sword. We use it all the time. It's our go-to metric for making quick and easy mortality comparisons across different contexts. So like comparing one country to another, or one time point to another, or one racial group to another. And what is really helpful about it is that it summarizes what's happening to everybody in just one number, and that lets you do a lot of comparisons at once. So that's important. What's not great about life expectancy is that it can be hard to interpret. And that's for two reasons. One is that it's giving you an average lifespan, but we're not always great at thinking about what averages mean. So when somebody dies at a young age, they, like, let's say they die as a child. If they hadn't died then, they might have many decades, maybe even a century more of life ahead of them. And so that death is going to change the average kind of a lot. Whereas if someone dies when they're at an older age, 60 or 70, they would not have had so many years of life left, even if they hadn't died then. And their death doesn't have as big an impact on the average. So the result of that is that life expectancy is incredibly sensitive to deaths that happen at young ages. And that's not a problem if you're used to interpreting it, right? So for professionals, we just sort of know to correct for that. We can picture what we're talking about. But I think that sometimes in public communication, it can be a little misleading. So like if you hear that a population has a life expectancy of 50, you think, wow, they probably don't have a lot of 70-year-olds in that population. That would be really old. And that's actually not true. A population with a life expectancy of 50, which is about the situation in the U.S. right before the 1918 pandemic, that would be a society where plenty of people would live into their 70s. But a lot of kids would be dying in infancy or early childhood, and that's why the life expectancy would be so low.
Oh, that's interesting. I never realized that. I'm just thinking about how sometimes we'll hear, you know, life expectancy back in the day, people only lived till they were 30, and now we're living longer. But then sometimes I feel like I hear the opposite, where it's like, no, they lived longer then, but we're not living as long because we're having so many health problems. So, it's just kind of interesting to kind of understand what exactly that means. So what did life expectancy, you mentioned before the flu pandemic of 1918, it was about 50 was the average age. What was causing that?
So the life expectancy back then, the main things that people died of were infectious disease, and those often killed infants and young children. So some of the big killers were flu and pneumonia, even before the 1918 pandemic. People frequently died of flu. Tuberculosis was a very major killer. That was especially true for African Americans, and it had an enormous amount to do with the conditions of life that were forced on Black migrants to cities, who were forced both by law and by violence to live in these intensely segregated and very crowded and dangerous conditions that were very conducive to tuberculosis. There was also more waterborne disease then than there is now. This is a period of time where sewage systems were being implemented and water treatment systems were being implemented in cities, but they weren't yet universal. And so you can imagine people living crowded together in a city without a great water treatment system. Like, that's just not a very healthy context. So those are the kinds of things that people might be dying of.
Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. So was there research and understanding back in those days that these were things that were having an effect on life expectancy? Or is this stuff that is usually decades later when you look back at what was happening at that time?
People definitely understood that infectious diseases were the main drivers of mortality, the main things that were killing people. And so a lot of public health movements really arose in this period. And they came about as ways to combat infectious disease usually. And so there was, some of those were really good things, like, you know, let's make sure that companies are not dumping all this waste into the river anymore. That's a great thing to do. Some of them were not so great, like some organized public health efforts of that time were basically like, let's harass immigrant mothers to have them be parents in a way that looks more like the dominant culture. And that was not particularly helpful for making anybody healthier. But the things that really mattered, I think, were just improved living conditions. Some of the labor struggles of that era mattered a lot. If you think about what it would have been like to work in these incredibly dirty factories with very little, running on coal-fired plants, very little effort to clean that up, working long hours, children working, you know, these are conditions where it kind of makes sense that people died at a young age, and starting to challenge some of that matters.
We were talking earlier in this program about how the pandemic that we're currently in got conversations started to look into inequities and things that communities have been facing for a long time. Did any of that come up in this 1918 pandemic? Was any of that noticed or, you know, changes yes. made?
And there's two things that are really important about this. One is a way that 1918 is different from today, which is that in the 1918 pandemic, there was racial inequality, but it was actually less than was typical for the time. So in 1918, in cities, which is where we have the best data, non-white people had death rates that were 35% higher than white people, which is a lot. But in other years of that era, for flu and pneumonia deaths, it would be more like 133% higher, so more than twice as high. So 1918 was actually stood out as a time of relative equality because white populations were hit hard by the flu in a way that was actually somewhat unusual. And that was noted at the time. There were a lot of community efforts in Black populations to take the flu seriously, to encourage people to do things that would limit flu transmission. And it seems like that had an effect. And there's some other theories, too, about why those disparities might have been smaller. And some of my research is about that. But I also want to say something that is the same about the flu and today, which is that when I looked at 1918, the level of mortality is just incredibly high. Life expectancy dropped in 1 year from 51 to 39. And that kind of 12-year drop is really unprecedented. And so in my field of mortality demography, we really talk about 1918 as this completely unique experience that's unlike anything else. And there's something right about that. But what I learned is that white mortality during the 1918 flu pandemic was actually less than Black mortality had been every single prior year. That shocked me. And I then started to wonder, will that be true in the COVID pandemic as well? So we don't have the final data for 2020 yet, but I asked how many white people would have to die of the COVID pandemic in 2020 for white life expectancy last year to be the best that Black life expectancy has ever been. And the answer is between 700,000 and 1 million excess white deaths, which of course is more than actually happened. So the upshot is, in 1918, and again a century later now, what we think of as these really extreme mortality levels, in some sense, is what Black Americans experience every single year.
That's fascinating and very, very interesting. When will you be able to sort of wrap up your research about the numbers from the past year?
We're waiting for data from the federal government and for the final 2020 mortality statistics, and I expect we'd have it in the next couple of months.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and definitely interested in learning more about your research and what you come up with. So hopefully we'll catch up with you again soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Wrigley Field is a sociologist at the University of Minnesota. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can always find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.